So let's go ahead and get started. Is that working? Yeah. God, where did they find this chair? This is nice. Pardon? So it came from the break area, didn't it? Anyway, chairs are a lot harder than this one. All right, so sit up straight, and we'll do a little. I'll tell you what, we'll do the. We'll do just a few minutes of meditation, just concentrating the mind. I think people here pretty. You know, new enough that maybe I will do some, you know, guided meditation. On this one, I think we'll do the 9-round breathing, and maybe throw in the Baz part of that Baz meditation. Kind of, it'll be very. Hopefully, it'll be clear when we do it. We'll do that, and then we'll do the prayers. It'll take about 15 minutes, then we'll do the prayers, and then we'll launch into our PowerPoint presentation. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll, I saw that. Okay, so just sit up, you know, with your back straight. If you're sitting in a chair, you want to sit a little. You don't want to be leaning back. You want to have your back straight, kind of like your vertebrae are stacked one on top of another, like coins, palms in the lap. Now, the 9-round breathing. I'll just show you. You can use your finger to occlude your nostril, but it's not really important that you can't just do it anyway, probably. Just breathe in one side and out the other without occluding the nostrils. So the main point is to do the visualization. So let me describe what we're doing. So it's like, and these are actually, you won't find them in an anatomy book, but there's a central channel. This is called the central channel. The Sanskrit word is the Shushuma. This is more relevant to the tantric, the esoteric teachings of Buddhism, where you're working more with energy than with conceptual mind. But anyway, this particular, also people who do yoga, you know, they talk about this pranayama and all this sort of stuff. It's like that. So the central channel, finger breath, runs just in front of the spinal column, and then the two side channels are like maybe the size of a straw, and they hook back like an umbrella handle. They go down right next to the central channel, and then 4 finger breaths below the navel, they join the central channel. That's all you need to visualize for this particular practice. And what we're going to do is visualize that we're breathing in the left nostril, and the air comes down that umbrella handle, and you follow it down. And as you breathe in, and the air comes, and goes, it connects with the right nadi, or right channel, and it comes up and goes out the right nostril as you exhale. So you inhale, goes down. Exhale. So we do that on the left side. As we exhale, we're breathing out all the energy of attachment. We'll do that 3 times. And then we'll do the opposite side 3 times, where you breathe in and then out the left side. And this time we're breathing out all the negative energy of aversion, anger, all that kind of icky negative energy. Then the last time we do it, we'll breathe in both nostrils. The air will come down to the central channel. And then when it reaches the central channel, rather than immediately exhale, I want you to hold your breath and draw and tighten the pelvic muscles, kind of like a Kegel exercise, if anybody knows what that is. But you just tighten the pelvic muscles and bring that energy up, and you can gently press down with the diaphragm. You're kind of creating a compression, very gentle compression at the navel. And you just hold your breath for, 15, 20, 30 seconds. And you don't want to get to the point where you're uncomfortable. And then you exhale. And as you exhale, you can imagine the energy dispels within the central channel. But out of the top of your head comes ignorance. So this is not that tricky to do. So we'll do that. In the left out the right three times, that's attachment. In the right out the left three times, that's aversion, anger, that type of negative energy. And then in both, and then you hold the energy at the navel. By the way, sometimes it's recommended to swallow as you inhale. And you can create that compression. Helps a little bit. And then you'll do that three times. It doesn't have to be on three successive breaths, because actually, after you exhale, you probably go, take a couple of deep breaths to get back into the rhythm of it. But you want to do that three times. And what you'll notice when you create that compression is a kind of a blissful energy. Well, you'll be able to generate some kind of blissful experience of bliss, but it's a mental bliss. Even though you feel it in your body, your mind is also affected by this. Just notice it. Don't make anything up about it, but you just do that three times, and that'll notice it. When the mind is blissful, it doesn't want to go anywhere. Very happy, very content when it's blissful. So you just notice that. All right, so we'll do that together. Yeah, so just breathe in. You just do it on your own. I think I've explained it enough. kind of set the motivation. At least from one point of view, it's the most important part of tonight. Even though there'll be some information that will be presented, you know, the result of tonight completely depends upon the kind of mind we bring to the teachings, and if our motivation is just, you know, to find some peace and happiness in this life, which is probably what most of us, you know, would like to have. I mean, we all want that, actually. Nothing wrong with that. But if that's the sole motivation, then, you know, we can do better than that. If it were to be reborn, have our next life go well, which, you know, as most of us probably raised Christians, are certainly exposed to it, and it seems like that's the main goal, is to live your life well so that the next life would be in heaven. So similar, and that's a Dharma motivation, actually. It's considered to be the lowest, you know, of the three motivations we could have, but it's a good one, to live your life well and with some thought of having a positive or a beneficial future life. Happy future life. And another motivation that's more auspicious is that you want to dedicate your practice to the complete elimination of all of your faults. So this is, if we could completely remove all of our faults and achieve the cessation of suffering. Okay, this is called nirvana, the complete freedom from suffering. And when we take the suffering away, we're not just left being like dull or neutral or anything like that. When the suffering's removed, our true nature can manifest, and it's blissful, it's happy, it's content. It's amazingly blissful. So nirvana, which is cessation of suffering, amazingly happy, blissful state. And this is definitely a more auspicious motivation. And then the most powerful motivation, which is powerful for many reasons, because it's the quickest way to accumulate tons of positive virtue. But when we understand how the mind works, this motivation of dedicating our practice, our spiritual evolution, you know, I'm doing it for one reason, and that's to help others. I dedicate my practice, my achievement of whatever realizations I gain on the path, all the way up to full enlightenment, dedicated all to the benefit of others. I must become enlightened in order to help others. I must help others. How do I do that? I get enlightened. I get enlightened. What is enlightenment? It's the complete elimination of our faults and the development to fully develop compassion, wisdom, kindness, power, skillful means, all those qualities that we attribute to a Buddha. Completely develop all of those qualities. That's what a Buddha is. So this is the motivation that's when you think about it, it's antithetical to our biggest enemy, which is our selfish, self-cherishing, me, I mentality. That's the problem. That's the mind that gets us into creates all the problems. And bodhicitta, or this awakening mind that I just described, is completely the opposite of that. And this is said to be the most powerful motivation for any action. Any action, but particularly our spiritual practice. It's not just about me. I don't live in this world independent of others. We all are interdependent. We're all linked together inextricably. And this really acknowledges that interdependence. So this takes a little effort. This is not it's not an instinct for us to dedicate our practice to others, to dedicate our awakening to Buddhahood in order to help others. But it's something that we need to begin to train our mind in that direction, little by little. Don't have to jump. Just take our time. Lamishi, this great Tibetan Lama that really is responsible for this center, he said, many times, he said, as much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. This kind of distills it down to the very basic ingredients of bodhicitta. As much as we can, we need to practice dedicating our life to others. Never, ever forgetting others. All right, and let's read the prayers. Prayers are all through this book, but say it again. 34. Okay. All right. So we'll do refuge and generating bodhicitta. Remember, I explained this ad nauseum the last two classes. Well, one thing you learn about Buddhism is there's a lot of repetition because we need it, and so again. First two lines, they distinguish a Buddhist from a non-Buddhist. So, and remember the motivation? We talked about this, the motivation for going for refuge, the three things that we talked about. I see a lot of heads nodding. Yeah. All right, so the first one, it's based on our understanding of the first two noble truths, right? So the first one is fear, dread. What other words can we use? Serious concern for our welfare, based on the fact that the Buddha taught the first truth was the truth of dukkha, that things that with the kind of mind we have. He called us worldlings. Doesn't sound good, does it? Worldlings. He said, with the kind of mind we have, impossible to find lasting happiness. Momentary happiness, oh, yeah, but lasting happiness, impossible. So having awareness of the fact that the nature of our existence with a mind that's out of control is dukkha, which is unsatisfactory. Okay? And the second noble truth was the truth of the cause of the suffering. So he says, you're sick, people. You, all worldlings are deranged. That's basically what he said. And then there's a cause for it. And the cause is karma. What goes around comes around. And delusions. And the principal delusions are greed and hatred and ignorance. And then pride and jealousy. And then 84,000 other ones. There's lots of delusions, but those are the kind of the principal ones. And they all, if you look underneath all of that, the tap root for all the delusions is egocentricity. It's our, you know, selfish, self-cherishing mind. So we get that in our head. We develop some understanding of that we're in a mess. But also, this is in the context of understanding that it's possible to be free. So the third and fourth noble truth, truth of cessation. So the Buddha claimed that this, that we're sick, there's a cause of the sickness, which is karma and delusion. And because these are all based on ignorance, they can, you know, the delusions can be removed, the negative karma can be finished. It's possible to stop our suffering. So the third noble truth is cessation, and the fourth is the path to the cessation. Okay, we call it in Tibetan Buddhism, the path is many different names, but Lam Rim, the stages of the path to enlightenment, is one of the ways we present it. So again, you know, this is to give us faith or confidence. So we, the causes to go for refuge are this fear, health, it's a healthy fear. It's the reason you don't run red lights and stuff. It's you know, this dread of living the rest of our life with a mind that's caught in this cycle of uncontrolled causation called samsara. So there's fear or dread, and then there's confidence in the path that it can stop our suffering. And again, this is a practice of a lifetime, isn't it? Because the more we practice, the more we see what a mess our mind is. But then the more we practice, as we make progress, we develop natural confidence in the path. So this is not, you know, the words don't get to the experience. The experience is for us to figure out. This is for us to get. But so these are the, and then the third cause of refuge is compassion. And lots of ways to think about it, but one is to have compassion for ourselves. Another is to, is because we, this bodhicitta motivation, we, you know, as practitioners of the Mahayana, you know, the universal vehicle of Buddhism, where bodhicitta is our motivation, you know, we want to help others, and you know, we have to commit to a path that will lead us in a way, in a direction that will help us be more effective in helping others. So it's out of our compassion for others that we take refuge, because this is the method that's going to help us stop the suffering of others. So again, three causes of going for refuge from a Mahayana perspective are dread, confidence, and compassion, or fear, faith, and compassion. Those three things. So that when we read this, these first two lines, this is saying, you know, I'm a Buddhist. If you're a Buddhist, if you're not, I mean, you can say the lines and not be a Buddhist for sure, but this is distinguishing people who have committed to the path versus those who haven't. And the second two lines are distinguishing people who practice Buddhism sometimes we call it the path of individual liberation. So the motivation is to stop one's own suffering. Great motivation, but what we're practicing is a universal vehicle where, in the Mahayana perspective, where we want to help others, we want to get enlightened, we want to become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Remember I said the six perfections? You know, the six perfections are the third line in here says, by my practice of giving and the other perfections. So this is the Bodhisattva path. This is the path of the spiritual warrior. It's ethics, generosity, patience or tolerance, enthusiastic perseverance, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the six perfections. So, all right, so we're going to do this together, and then we'll do the four measurables. And the first measurable, happiness and the causes of happiness, that's love. That's the mind of love. To be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, that's the definition of compassion. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And this is joy. And then the last line has to do with equanimity. So we'll do that. We'll just do these two prayers, and then that'll be enough. So first one we do three times. I go for refuge in time enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. We launch into the PowerPoint presentation. So I want to read some. This is, I read some of the Dalai Lama's text. This is from the readings that are, we're supposed to do for the class. And I asked people just to read, you know, His Holiness and this one by Lama Yeshe. But I'm just going to read just the first stanza because it kind of tells you how Lama feels about us, or about Buddhism in general. I think I said this last time, but there's no word in Tibetan for Buddhism. It's called an inner being. It's like being an inner being. So when Lama was, you know, talking about Buddhism, he said, you know, don't get all twisted about all the, you know, when you look at this little book, you get all bent out of shape about all the things you're supposed to do and things you're not supposed to do and all that. Don't worry about that. I mean, those are details, and they're not unimportant, but the most important thing when one takes refuge is we recognize that what we've been doing up until now has not worked. It's like we've been looking for, call it, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places, but it's a little bit deeper than that. We've been looking for happiness outside ourselves. And this is about looking inside, becoming, as Lama called it, he said, you know, now the word for Buddha means kind of inner, means inner being, or the Buddhist in Tibetan means inner being. So someone who's like trying to solve their problems in their heart, in their mind, instead of looking outside for answers to everything, including our happiness. So this is a little taste of Lama Yeshe's style. When you take refuge in Buddha Dharma, the important point is that you have recognized your own profound potential, and from the beginning can see that I can do something. I can take the responsibility of liberating myself. This is different from the attitude we normally have. I'm hopeless. Maybe God, maybe Buddha, maybe Lama can do something for me. This sort of human attitude is wrong. From the Buddhist point of view, it is wrong to think I'm hopeless. Buddha can do something for me. The attitude is wrong because it's not true. By believing that you're hopeless, you've already decided that you're nothing. you have already put a limit on your profound quality. So the important thing is taking refuge is that you have the understanding that you do the understanding that you can do something to solve the problem of everyday life by relying with confidence and trust on the Buddha's wisdom. Or you can also call it your own activated wisdom to liberate you from confusion and suffering. So it is really worthwhile. The real significance of taking refuge in Buddha wisdom is that it is the entrance to the path to enlightenment. And so everything, you know, that we do here at Gadamba Center, particularly in, you know, the more, yeah, I mean, I'd say the more, some of the more profound teachings, and particularly in the Vajrayana path, you know, you have to have taken refuge. Now, there's a ceremony for taking refuge, which maybe some of you have done. And then there's, if you take the Bodhisattva vows, or if you ever take a tantric initiation, the refuge is all part of the ceremony. But I really don't recommend people do that. I recommend if you want to commit to any path, or this, but we're talking Buddhism here, you know, I think it is important to participate in a formal ceremony, because it stamps that in our mind, in our mental continuum, is this is really important enough for me to show up for a ceremony just dedicated to my my spiritual life. So, you know, Lama Yeshe used to emphasize it's really important to actually take refuge in a ceremony. Now, in the text that I've read, you don't really have to do that, but you know, a little bit of difference of opinion, ideally we would have taken refuge before we ever went to a ceremony, right? So the people decide to get married, I mean, they're committed. They just go to the ceremony to reinforce the commitment and do it in front of a lot of people. It empowers the commitment. So it's the very same way with, you know, taking refuge in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So without any further blah, 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 let's get on to the PowerPoint. And I think most people, do you have a copy of this? So you can, I think you can make notes if you want to on this. This is fine. And this is, these are some things that I thought were important 10 years ago when I made this up. But we'll see. Okay. What does the term refuge mean? This is out of the dictionary, I think. Shelter or protection from danger and distress, something to which one has recourse in difficulty. The term refuge in Buddhism, though, we think of it as, it's kind of defined as putting a safe, positive direction in our life. So it's not exactly that. Refuge is that thought. I need my laser pointer. Don't I? Anyway, I don't have to sit down. So, is that thought, which, this sounds a little weird, by the way, but these are some notes that I took. Refuge is that thought which, of its own power, puts all its hopes in another object. Two kinds of refuge. Ordinary refuge, we've talked about this. People in the world take refuge, am I in the way? Can you see more? Take refuge in worldly or material things. We talked about the eight worldly dharmas, didn't we? You know, on one side we had everything that's delicious, everything that we put everything in the world that's delicious in four categories. We called it gain, pleasure, fame, and praise. Okay, and the opposites are things that we don't want. So ordinary beings, we put all of our, you know, what we want are, this is what we want. And so these are material things. Exceptional, ultimate refuge. Buddhist refuge, the state, is refuge in the three jewels. So Buddhas, the enlightened beings, the Dharma, or the realizations of those teachings, and the Sangha, are those beings that that have realized the teachings and can guide us. So Buddhist refuge and the three jewels. When you have refuge, you have a state of mind of being fearful. Remember, we talked about that. And go for protection with absolute certainty that will help. So the fearful part has to do with the dread, and it has to do with an understanding of the first two noble truths. And the absolute certainty that it will help, protection, has to do with the third and fourth noble truth, the cessation of suffering and the path of cessation. Practice of a lifetime. Practice of a lifetime. It'll start out as a little, if it starts out, and there's no guarantee, but if you find something helpful in Buddhism, it'll be like a little flame. And then as you practice more and more, it will grow. And if it doesn't grow, you can blame who? The Dalai Lama? The teachings? Maybe you can blame the teachings, but maybe it has to do with our practice too. How do I change it? Thank you. All right. Definition of Buddhist refuge is formally putting a safe and positive direction in our lives, indicated by the three jewels, and pledging to maintain the steady direction unwaveringly until it brings us to liberation, nirvana. Okay, liberation, the cessation of suffering. This is the goal of the Hinayana, hate to say that word, arhat. So it's somebody who practices the individual vehicle for individual liberation. It's a great thing. I mean, to stop your own suffering is huge achievement. And you can really help a lot of people just by doing that. But enlightenment, the full enlightenment of Buddhahood is not, it's like the train keeps going beyond nirvana. That's just that's the first station. And Buddhahood is like, not only have we stopped our suffering, but we've developed all of the qualities that we have to the fullest extent so that we can really help others. That's what's necessary to truly be of benefit, is to become Buddha. So, again, most of us have no confidence that, as Lama's saying, we don't think we have the ability to do, to evolve to any extraordinary degree. And so that's our biggest obstacle. That's our biggest obstacle, is that we have what I call a spiritual inferiority complex. We don't have faith in our own potentials. And I think once we practice a little bit and see our minds moving in the direction that we always wanted it to move in, but we couldn't quite figure out how to get there, and now we're beginning to practice and we're beginning to see that some of these qualities are beginning to grow. That gives us some faith that, well, maybe it's possible to grow my compassion infinitely, and grow the loving kindness that I'm able to generate a little bit infinitely, like that. All right, next one. I think I will sit down. So what are the three jewels? So these are the Sanskrit words. Buddha, the awakened one. Now there's a whole list, and I just couldn't put that down, of the qualities of a Buddha, but you can read that in the text. But a Buddha is somebody who's a being who's omniscient. Okay, Buddhas are not omnipotent. What's omnipotent mean? All powerful. When we talk about God, the notion of God, and I'm not speaking for everybody, but we think omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. What's another omni? Anyway, so a lot of omnis everywhere, existing everywhere. But Buddhas are not omnipotent. Oh my goodness. Thank you. Right there. How about that? Buddha's I feel like a real teacher now. Be careful. So Buddhas are not omnipotent, but they are omniscient. And when your mind, and I'm going to say everybody in here is going to get enlightened, when our mind achieves the state of enlightenment, it's like there's no limit. A Buddha's mind, this sounds a little weird, but it also sounds a lot like God. It pervades the entire universe and every atom. There are countless Buddhas. Our mind pervades the entire universe. So there's no limitation. So Buddha's mind is omnipresent. It's omnipotent. No, omniscient, but it's not omnipotent. We're not all, because the Buddhas can't save us. The Buddhas teach us how to save ourselves. And so the Tibetan word for Buddha, Sangha, meaning clear and purified, and Ge means evolved. So someone who's you know, clear and evolved and purified. Then the actual Buddha jewel, so here we go. All right, the actual Buddha jewel is any omniscient being, such as a historical Buddha. Now we're getting into some of the technology that I promised you wouldn't like, but it's just a part of the class, so just hang in there with me. But it's interesting. So, and the conventional Buddha jewel is any representation. So the statues here, all the images on the wall are different manifestations of Buddha. You know, females and males, and the Buddha, you know, Buddha consciousness is not male or female. It's any omniscient mind. So the conventional Buddha, you know, we use the statue and the art to remind us of the actual Buddha, but they aren't the actual Buddha. Now, next one. Alright, now this is the Dharma jewel. That which holds us back from suffering. So that's the Sanskrit definition of Dharma. So we're talking about a particular kind of Dharma. If you had a medical textbook, you could say, well, that's Dharma, right? Because there's stuff in there or whatever, you know, things that hold us back from suffering. But the Buddha Dharma particularly is what we're talking about in terms of that which holds us back from suffering or dukkha. The actual Dharma jewel are the realizations in the minds of Arya beings. Any true path and true cessation in the mind of an Arya. So now what that means, Arya is a Sanskrit word that means someone who's had direct insight into emptiness. So these people have, these beings have a realization of a true path. So what's that? Which noble truth is that? That's the fourth noble truth and the third noble truth. So they realize the cessation of suffering through practicing the path. That's an Arya being. And they've had a direct insight into emptiness. And the conventional Dharma jewel is any text. So, you know, we have text, we call these Dharma text, and we treat them with respect. You know, we try not to put them on the ground. We try not to step on them or over them, and people think that's hokey. But, you know, it's kind of an, you know, like, why are we doing this? But it's to teach us to be mindful and respectful of things that are designed to help us stop our suffering. And so, that's just one of the little, you'll see sometimes people walk around, you know, and be, you know, if somebody's getting ready to step over something, they'll pull it right out from under them, or they'll make sure they'll take books off the floor and put them someplace like that. And it's just a practice to be respectful, to be mindful of and respectful of the Dharma. The ultimate refuge is the Dharma. It's not the Buddha, and it's not the Sangha. This is the ultimate refuge, because this is what's going to stop our suffering. The Buddha can't stop our suffering, and the Sangha can't stop our suffering. But realizing the Dharma, that can stop our suffering. Next. All right. Now, Sangha. Sangha. Sanskrit. Those who have joined together to realize the teachings and methods. Excuse me. So, actual Sangha jewel is any person who's had a direct intuitive insight into the wisdom of emptiness, attained the path of seeing. Could be a lay person, could be a monastic, doesn't matter. But that's the actual Sangha. Now, the conventional Sangha, and this goes, there's a lot of, you know, not really a lot of debate, but it's a group of four or more fully ordained monks and nuns. So, in any country, I don't want to go into that. But anyway, that's the conventional Sangha. Now, we use this term loosely in Western culture. Like, we consider ourselves here at the center like Sangha, even those of us that are not monks and nuns. We call everybody who comes here, we're all Sangha, because we're all here to support one another. But if we want to get real technical about it in a formal sense, it's four or more fully ordained monks or nuns. Okay, next. All right, the conventional jewels are not the actual jewels. So the conventional jewels are not the actual jewels. The practice of Buddhism does not entail worship of idols, texts, or monks and nuns. Is that clear? Even though it doesn't look that way, does it? When we do prostrations, it looks like we're worshiping this statue back here, or these statues, you know, all this. But we have to have some understanding what we're doing when we're doing this. What's the statue reminding us of? It's reminding us of the enlightened beings, and we need to have respect for them. You know, at the most profound level, we're paying homage to our own potential to be a Buddha, to our own potential to realize the Dharma, to our own potential to be an authentic Sangha support for the spiritual community. So, you know, I really, and you know, several people, some great teachers have said, you know, we're more interested in ourselves, aren't we? I mean, bottom line, we're motivated by self-interest. That's it. And so, if you know, we, you know, these other things sound good, but we are very interested in our own potential to achieve these states. So, I think that's what's maybe the biggest message of all about taking refuge in our own potential, and just in a practical sense too. And I may have mentioned this before, but. You know, somebody who's practicing Buddhism, the reason the practice of, well, let's go ahead, because this is coming up in another one of my slides. So let's see here. What do we ordinarily go for refuge in? So we already did this one. A lot. Gain, pleasure, fame, and praise. All the delicious stuff. Remember what we said? And we go for refuge in, the more we're addicted to pleasure, the more we fear and dread and cannot stand these, right? So the attachment to this creates an aversion to this. Now, having stuff, not a problem. Not a problem to have pleasure and material stuff and be famous and be praised. Well, there's nothing wrong with any of this. Buddhism's not saying there's anything wrong with it. But when we cling to it, it becomes poisonous. Because in the moment that we cling to gain, the flip side of that is loss. We fear loss. The moment that we cling to pleasure, the fear of pain is right there in the same moment. And so it's the clinging that's the problem to these delicious things that creates the aversion to these things. And life goes like this, doesn't it? We have pleasure, and we have gain, and then we have loss, and we have pain. And it's like this, like a sine curve. And there's no way to be happy if the only way we can be happy is to have these things. But what's another characteristic of these things that's really important that we don't get? What's another feature of everything in samsara? It doesn't last. It's always in a state of change. And, you know, it's always in a state of flux. So nothing lasts. Our pleasures don't last. Our fame doesn't last. You know, and in the end, we have to give it all up. Even the thing that we cling to most, which is our own identity, we have to let that go. When we die, we lose everything. So, you know, again, letting go is the solution to the addiction or the addiction to deliciousness. And this is us. This is our life. I can promise you, anytime you're uncomfortable and you look in your mind, you're thinking, if you're in pain, the thought, you know, with the pain is, I can't stand it. Get me to neutral. I'd love to have pleasure, but I cannot stand pain. You know, so that it's right there in the moment. Anytime we're uncomfortable, it's because we wish things were different than they were. We're in essence, we're attached to that. The Four Noble Truths, again, The first two help us realize that this dread or fear that we need to go for refuge, and the second two have to do with the confidence that we've gone over. So, you know, truth of suffering, cause of suffering, and again, I see some new faces here, but we've gone over this quite a bit. And this is like the first thing the Buddha taught when he got enlightened under the Bodhi tree to his first disciples, he taught it. He said, all worldlings are deranged. Okay, you're sick. Here's the cause of your sickness, which is delusion and karma. He said, good news, you can be cured, and here's the medicine. Right? And so Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we liken those to the doctor. The Buddha is like the doctor, the skillful physician. The Dharma is like the medicine. And the Sangha are like the nurses that give the medicine. They help us take the medicine to cure our problems. Sorry, next one. All right, what is this? Going for refuge. Okay, we've done this. We can move. We can go on. All right, cause of refuge in the Buddha is going to refuge in beings who are already enlightened. So cause of refuge, this is just technical words, you don't have to remember this. But the resultant refuge in the Buddha is in the Buddha we will become. So this is what we're talking about. We're taking refuge in our own Buddha potential. Cause of refuge is in the Buddha, going to refuge to beings who are already enlightened. And so, yeah, it's paying respect to them, and they're worthy of respect, but the resultant refuge is to refuge to our own Buddha potential. Alright, next. Cause of refuge in the Dharma is going to refuge to the realizations in others' mental continuum. So the realizations of the path and true cessations. So that's the causal refuge in the Dharma. The resultant refuge in the Dharma is in our own future realizations. Next. And causal refuge in the Sangha is going to refuge to the superior Aryas. Remember, Sanskrit word for those beings who've had direct insight into emptiness and have already become Sangha. And then resultant refuge is the superiors that we will become. Again, we're much more interested in the result of Buddha refuge, Dharma refuge, and Sangha refuge. We're much more interested in our own potential to become Buddha, realize the Dharma, and then become a true Sangha. Next. Alright, guess you can jump a gap. So he died a few years ago. Let's go back. Yeah. We should go for refuge in our own future Buddha. I already said this, but he's the one I'm quoting. We should go for refuge in our own future Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, as this will generate more interest in the refuge practice, and consequently we will put more energy into it. Okay? Alright, now, three kinds of faith. Yeah, in Buddhism, I have to say, I think we're a little bit arrogant about this. Sometimes we say, well, everything's based on reasoning. And there's a real emphasis on direct, you know, on using your own experience as the ultimate test of the value of anything. But at some level, in the beginning, you sort of have to have faith. Even to sit down and meditate, you have some faith that, well, I read a book by the Dalai Lama, and he said, if I did this, or Joseph Goldstein, or whoever, and he said, if I did this, I would be happier, or John Kabat-Zinn, and so I'm going to give it a try. So that's faith, isn't it? I mean, and then over time, we can actually have a direct experience of the benefit of it, but it takes faith. So there's different kinds of faith in Buddhism, and it is considered to be a really positive mental thing. Sometimes we call it a mental factor or an aspect of the mind, but be able to develop a genuine faith based on your experience is the most powerful faith you can have. Now, we can do the next one. Alright. Song Rinpoche said this. Oh yeah, this is in the first handout. Now, many of you may, now you may hear many teachings, but the main fundamental thing you need to know is how to take refuge, what the essence of refuge is, what karma is, and how it's created. Those are the main things you need to know. And this is from a man who's considered to be a tantric master, you know, a great scholar, a saint. You know, he taught, you know, thousands and thousands of people, but he's kind of distilled it down to refuge and karma. I mean, that's a little shocking when you think about it. So what is it about refuge that's so important? I mean, it's a good question. I think, well, let me put it this way. For, you know, someone who's truly taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and has studied and has put these teachings into practice, 24/7, you know, you're using the teachings, you're making your every effort to be mindful in the moment and to bring wisdom to the moment and to bring, you know, compassion to the moment and to bring whatever Dharma teaching and quality you need to handle situations in the moment. And so, you know, if you go to work and you have a problem with your boss or with a coworker, and you just react, well, that's one way to do it, isn't it? But the other thing you can do is to just, you know, as someone who's taken refuge, is, okay, this person's upset at me. I can feel my anger and my negativity, negative mind beginning to arise. Now's the time to bring some teachings to the moment, bring some wisdom to bear on that moment, being mindful that that our mind is sort of disturbed, bringing some wisdom to that moment and solving that problem right then, and noticing the anger beginning to rise, being aware that that is not a healthy state of mind, being aware of the negative karmic consequences of anger, all of that Dharma wisdom, we bring it to that moment and we let go of the anger and the aversion that was beginning to rise in our mind, and then we don't get tagged. That's the real refuge. That is really taking refuge, because it's using the teachings to solve our problems in that moment. It's very, very important. So, you know, refuge is something we practice 24/7 as Buddhists. It's not just saying these four lines, this little prayer. That's not taking refuge. I mean, it's the ritual of taking refuge, and it points us at something, but it's really much more profound than that. It's really using the teachings all the time to, you know, to solve our problems and make good choices and to create the causes for happiness, which is good karma, and to purify our mind of negativities, which is, you know, causes us to suffer. So, next one, please. All right, this is a Dalai Lama. This is, if you're a Buddhist, it is a result of your own choice. So, again, this gets down to the point of, nobody's begging anybody to be a Buddhist. But, you know, the Buddhist perspective was, come and see for yourself. Like, I like this about, this is something I really like about Buddhism. Check it out. Check it out for yourself. If it fits, if it works for you, if it helps your mind, if it makes you happy, it doesn't harm you, doesn't harm others, go for it. If it doesn't work for you, don't go for it. It's that simple. It's not a, but it's up to us as good mind scientists to prove that the teachings are valid. The Buddha doesn't need to prove the teachings are valid. The Buddha's already done the work. It's up to us to test these teachings, using our own life experience and see if it works. And the claim is it does, and it's up to us to find out. So, she said, therefore, you should qualify yourself accordingly. The minimal qualifications to be a Buddhist is to avoid the 10 negative courses of action and cultivate the opposites. So we've talked about this too. The 10 non-virtues, we talk about the three of body. So the three of body are, they're obviously more than this, but there's killing and stealing and sexual misconduct. The four of speech are lying, slander, harsh, and frivolous gossip. And then the three of mind are greed, hatred, and ignorance. So obviously there's more than that. But he said this is the minimum. So he said we should avoid those and as much as possible cultivate their opposites. So the opposite of killing is what? Saving lives. The opposite of stealing would be practicing generosity, I guess. The opposite of adultery or sexual misconduct is being, you know, is really being respectful of other people's feelings and making good choices in that realm of being. Then the opposite of lying is being truthful. Of slander is praise. Of harsh speech is harmonious speech, and gossip and that kind of, you know, frivolous speech is speaking mindfully, you know, not wasting people's time with idle gossip. And then greed, hatred, and ignorance. The opposite of clinging and greed is what? I mean, what's the opposite of? I don't know if this is really the opposite of it or not, but it's, we think of it as letting go, isn't it? The remedy for clinging is letting go. The remedy for anger is said to be compassion, and the remedy for ignorance is wisdom. So practicing the opposite. So it's telling us to say that's what we're, and again, those are all interstate, you know, these are the body and the mind, I'm sorry, the body and the speech are controlled by what? The mind. So the real work has to be done on the mind. So in the beginning, to protect ourselves from a mind that's wild, we try to put some limits on our behavior. This is why we talked about the ten, the five precepts in Buddhist lay countries. And Lama Yeshe, as I said, he led us. I don't think everybody heard this, but when I took refuge back in the day, they were like, it was in Kathmandu, and there were like 200, maybe, I don't know, maybe 100 or 150 people took refuge. But almost everybody there was in Nepal because of the drug scene. And it was really kind of a wild, like the wild, wild west. And so everybody, you know, anyway. So Lama said, okay, well, there are five lay precepts. Avoid killing, stealing, adultery, or sexual misconduct, lying, and intoxicants. And remember, and he said, take one or all of them. And he said, if you can't even commit to any of those five, make up something. Make up a little one or modify. You know, you say, well, I can't give up intoxicants, but maybe you can give them up for one day a week or decrease your consumption or something. But he was very generous about that. And he saw the value in making a commitment from a mindfulness perspective, isn't it? When we make a promise, it makes us mindful. If I promise to not, like, run red lights, I stop at red lights. If I'm in a relationship and I promise to be, you know, with just this one person, then when the opportunity comes to go off with somebody else, I go, wait a minute. It wakes us up. So commitments are our friend. The commitments help us and protect us from our mind that's out of control. So, you know, we ordinarily think of like, oh, you know, like I have to make a commitment to, or a vow to avoid killing and stealing and adultery and lying and getting loaded. Oh, that's just going to restrict me. I can't have any fun anymore. But no, I mean, or there's no freedom in that. We think that way sometimes, don't we? That we can't be free. We can't be spontaneous. But my argument against that is that the mind that's being free and spontaneous is not a mindful mind. It's the mind driven by ego for us. And so what's likely to happen is we're going to create the causes for more suffering. And you want to call it, that's not really spontaneous. We can call that spontaneity, but that's really, what's another word for it? It's crazy. It's craziness. Now, within making some very simple commitments to avoid, you know, things that when we sit down and think about it, are all actions driven by confusion and egocentricity and are going to cause suffering. When we make commitments like that, it protects us. And so now you can still have fun. We can still have a great time, but we know that there are limits to what we're going to do because we've made a promise to ourselves to not do it. All right. Is that the end of it?
No, we lost connection
for me. Okay. We lost what now?
Lost connection.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, everybody's got it, so let's see what page we're on. The five precepts I just went over. Oh, there they go. Yep. Then the commitments of taking Buddhist refuge. So these are the things that those of you who have taken refuge, this is the stuff that's really dry, but we'll go over it anyway. All right, having taken refuge, and if you have questions, because some of you may be thinking of taking refuge or already have, all right, so this is having taken refuge. Oh, let me say this. If you've taken refuge in Buddhism, does that mean that you can't go to a Christian church anymore? Of course you can. You can go to the synagogue, you can go to the mosque, you can go to the Christian church, you can go anywhere you want to. But it just means that at the end of the day, you know where, you know, you don't abandon your ultimate refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Really what we're trying to do is become kinder, we want to become better human beings. We want to develop wisdom and compassion and loving kindness. We can learn those things in church. I used to love to go to church with my mom after I became a Buddhist, because I could finally understand the psychology. When I understand Buddhist psychology, I could sort of translate Christianity into it. I had no problem going to church. I didn't want to be a Christian again, but I was a Presbyterian, whatever that means. Having taken refuge in Buddha, one should not take refuge from the depth of one's heart in worldly gods or, you know, other spiritual traditions. Not that we can't learn from them and benefit from them, but ultimately, once you take refuge in the Buddha, then that's your ultimate refuge. All right, having taken refuge in the Dharma, one should avoid harming any living being either directly by oneself or indirectly by calling the exterminator. I'm sorry. Did I say that? Okay. Sometimes you just have to invite the insects out. All right. Having taken refuge in the Sangha, one should avoid entrusting oneself to and keeping company with negative friends and followers of hedonism. So say goodbye to all your friends and come to Kadampa Center, where we're still hedonists too, but we're working on it. You know, there's a middle way here. But you know, my grandmother said it better than she used to say. You lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. You know, if you hang out with people, or worse, lice, or even worse than that, scabies. So, you know, it's just, we all know this, that we are influenced by our environment. And at some point, when we become a true Sangha, when we have an insight into emptiness, and we can actually become the true valid Sangha, we can go anywhere. And we become an inspiration to people who really are having a lot of trouble. So, but depending on where we are in our own spiritual evolution, you know, we probably need to protect ourselves to some degree. And so that's the value of a spiritual community, a place like Kadampa Center, I think, is that most people are trying to be better people. Not that people in churches and other places aren't, but they're using this method, you know, refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, as the source of guidance in becoming better people. And so we need to watch who we hang out with, particularly people that influence us to, you know, to go down the wrong path. All right, next one. What is to be practiced? One should regard even the statues as actual Buddhas and even prostrate and pay, straight and pay respect to them. I said prostate, but I didn't mean that. bringing my work to... Anyway, okay. So regard all statues as a as the actual Buddha. Well, that sounds like we're worshiping statues, doesn't it? It does, even to me. But I know that's not true because I just read earlier we don't worship statues, and so but we see them as representations of the Buddha. Okay, we're not worshiping metal or images. We're worshiping.
So explain again what we are doing when we prostrate.
Well, we're paying homage to the enlightened beings and their teachings and the Sangha, the spiritual community. So we're paying homage to them. We're showing respect to them and bowing and forever and ever. Bowing has always been a show of respect, particularly in Asian cultures. So that's that. But we're also paying homage to our own potentials to become enlightened, to realize the Dharma and become the actual Sangha. So there's a lot to be mindful of while we're doing this. And then, we put our hands here and you can have an elaborate visualization like over here with all these, hundreds of beings in the air, like the moon surrounded by the stars, like the Buddha with all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas surrounding. Or you can just see the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, an image of the Buddha, like a hologram, a symbolic of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, of all three objects of refuge. And then as you do it, you can visualize, like white light purifying your body, and red light purifying your speech, and blue light coming from the Buddha, purifying your mind. So there's a lot of ways to embellish the practice, but that's what generally, it's just to show respect, and it's an antidote. Prostrations are an antidote to arrogance and pride, and it's a huge obstacle to learning, isn't it? Because if we think we have all the answers, then we can't learn, because I already know the answer. We've already made up our mind how it is. So, it's a way to develop humility, which is, a good thing in the path. And then there are other teachings on how it purifies physical negative karma by prostrating, and there's a lot, to it. Okay, so now, what is to be practiced? One should regard even statues. And also you shouldn't make a, it may be in another slide, but we shouldn't make a big distinction between, that Buddha is more beautiful, the artwork on that one's better than this one, even though our natural instinct is to make that. But we're more interested in what it symbolizes, which is the enlightened, the accomplishments of the Buddhas, the enlightened beings. And the Dharma, one should respect all scriptures and texts as being the actual Dharma. The actual Dharma is what? It's the realizations, isn't it? So, alright, and then the Sangha, one should regard one member of the Sangha as being the actual Sangha. So, any monk or nun as being the actual Sangha. So, this is a tough one for Westerners, because when we see monks and nuns, we don't, in Asian cultures, particularly in Thailand and places like that, and also in Tibetan culture too, monastic people are really revered and treated with great respect. But Westerners, we don't, particularly the Western Sangha members that have become monks and nuns, we don't show them that kind of respect. So it's something we need to work on. Because respect is good for us. It's really good for our mind. And it helps Sangha members too, but it's really good for us. All right, next. All right, general advice. One should rely upon holy beings, listen to the holy Dharma, and correctly comprehending, follow the Dharma and practice it. So this one, I don't know if there's another one up here, but we should when we take refuge in the Dharma, we should make an effort to seek out teachings. We shouldn't like stay home on Sunday morning and lounge around. We should come to the center and get the teachings, or go someplace and get the teachings, or avail ourselves of the opportunity to receive the teachings. So relying on the holy beings, listen to the holy Dharma, and after correctly comprehending, follow the Dharma and practice it. Alright? Then, I think there's one other thing. Yeah, I think we just need to make an effort to expose ourselves to the teachings as much as possible. I've said this earlier on, but the teachings that we receive, you know, that we're fortunate enough to receive, have come down to us in an unbroken lineage, and this is a big deal in Buddhist communities. This whole notion of an unbroken lineage. That the teachings weren't in, you know, didn't pop up a thousand years ago or 500 years ago, but they actually come down, you know, and how do we know? You know, we don't know, but we're taking this on faith again to some degree. But the teachings have come down in an unbroken lineage from the time of the Buddha to the present day. They haven't been distorted. They haven't been changed. We're actually getting the true, you know, the authentic teachings of the Buddha. And an unbroken lineage is not just that the books are still here. An unbroken lineage implies that the Buddha taught his disciples who heard the teachings, put them into practice, and then realized the teachings in their own continuum. They developed those realizations, and then they taught their students, who then developed realizations and taught their students. So that's what constitutes an unbroken lineage. And so that makes it even more powerful and more precious that we're getting the teachings in an unbroken lineage. And then one should not let one's senses become excited. That is, one should control the senses when in danger of creating negative karma. But that doesn't sound like anything we want to do, does it? Excitement? What's wrong with excitement? You know, we all want excitement. Next. No, I'm just kidding. Why is excitement a problem? Why is that? Anybody? I haven't heard from this side of the room. But then again, I hadn't heard from this side of the room. Yeah, I have. But, yeah.
I might have lost my train of thought.
Pardon?
My guess is that when you become excited, you lose mindfulness of what you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's considered to be an obstacle. When we're meditating, you know, anything that, and there's a teaching on this 52 minds and mental factors, and one of the definitions of something that's, let's just call it non-helpful or negative, would be anything that disturbs our tranquility of mind. You know, a peaceful, calm, happy mind. And excitement, unfortunately, you know, is kind of different, isn't it? I mean, it's not a calm, peaceful, tranquil mind. So by that definition, excitement is a problem. And again, excitement, if we see something, again, all the things that we talked about that are delicious, you name it, you know, we get excited about these things sometimes, and we go off and do things that we shouldn't do, and all because we want a thrill, like a nice roller coaster. Okay, one should have a compassionate attitude towards sentient beings, so just do that. Right? Like the bumper sticker says, just do that. Have a compassionate attitude towards sentient beings. But that's not easy to do, is it? I mean, we can all say, I'd like to be more compassionate, but it's not going to happen. Hope is not a strategy. A strategy for being more compassionate is to do the practices, is to meditate on one's own state of suffering, understand how others are suffering, understand emptiness, and see how when we understand the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, their hearts just completely, overcome with concern and compassion for sentient beings, the ones who realize emptiness, because they see how, we ordinary beings, we project a world. We think that what we see is the truth. And so everything that's delicious, we cling to, and anything that looks like it's going to threaten us, we feel aversion toward, and we're just tossed around in samsara, in this cyclic existence, with the mind completely out of control, completely addicted to appearances. And when we see that those are just appearances, that they're not the truth, it's possible to truly develop compassion. So in the beginning, we have to really start with ourselves, have some compassion for ourselves. And to do that, we have to be honest with ourselves and realize that we're not okay, that we're sick. The First Noble Truth, the Buddha said, all worldlings are deranged. And so if you question that, then from a Buddhist perspective, check out and see if your mind is out of control. And if your mind is the source of 99.999% of your problems and suffering. And if you come to the conclusion that it is, then you want to wish yourself well. You want to be free of suffering. That's called compassion for yourself. That's also the first step in the practice of Dharma called renunciation. So when eating or drinking, one should make an effort to offer to the rare sublime three jewels. One should train well, in the refuge precepts, exhorting oneself to make offerings to three jewels. So usually before you eat or drink something, you should mentally, and it's real easy to do this, you can go say a little mantra, or you just think, I'm going to offer this to the three jewels. The pleasure of this beverage or whatever to the three jewels. But there's a little prayer, Om Ahom. Sometimes just Om Ahom, a real easy way to bless something before you eat it. But then Lama Zopa, our teacher, the teacher, spiritual director for the center, he often will do a 30 minutes to an hour blessing of the food. Goes cold, everybody's going, okay, when are we going to eat? He's still blessing the food. So one should train well in refuge precepts, exhorting oneself to make offerings to three jewels. So we should say the refuge formula three times in the morning, three times in the day, and every day we should make offerings to the three jewels. That's what it says there. Okay, next one. Common questions. Can or should Buddhists have fun? Absolutely not. Lama Yeshe said, fun? We should have, he said, because people said, looks like Buddhists can't have fun. He said, I want you to have amazing fun. I want you to have the most fun of all. I want you to have bliss nonstop. But I don't want you to create the causes for more suffering while you're doing this. So he said, yeah, I want you to have fun. I want you to have great fun. But kind of fun that's going to, be helpful to your mind and to your future life. So, yeah. And can we have fun? I've been to Disney World way too much. And I actually have a good time. I dread going there. Every time I go, I got to get back to Disney World. And then I have no expectations. So, of course, I have a great time because I'm not attached to having fun. I figured it out. If we don't have expectations, then it's much easier to enjoy the moment. So, we should have fun. We should have, in those eight worldly dharmas, gain, pleasure, fame, and praise, there's nothing wrong with those things. Absolutely nothing wrong. We just have to realize that our clinging to them creates suffering for us. And we don't want that. So we need to let go, and we need to also being aware of the impermanence of them helps to let go. Does it matter who I take refuge vows from? No. If you take refuge, you're taking, you can go, if you take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, that means you could be, you could become a Zen Buddhist, you could practice Theravada Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. It's not, you're not just taking refuge in the Galupa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. You're taking refuge in all of the Dharma and all the Buddhas and the Sangha. So that's, yeah. Do I really need to commit to Buddhist refuge in a formal ceremony? And I've addressed that. Lama says we should do it. And I've read other places it's not necessary. But Lama says we should do it. And I think he's right. I think it makes a difference. It's kind of the difference between getting married at the Justice of the Peace, you know, when there's like nobody there, you know, except your spouse, and then getting married in, you know, in a sacred place with a priest or, you know, with someone that, you know, like that, with all your friends and people that you love and respect. And now they're seeing you make this commitment. It's much more powerful. It makes a bigger impression in our mental continuum. And we, you know, it's just as it's not a good idea to take refuge and go back on it. It's like any important commitment in your life. If you make that commitment and then turn your back on it, there are huge negative karmic consequences. And we don't want that. So, you make sure if you take refuge that you've already, if you go to a ceremony, you only go there to empower the commitment that you've already made. It's not something that you go there and think, well, I'm going to decide when I get to the ceremony. Uh-uh. You've already decided, you know the value of it, you're clear what you're doing, and there are no back doors. All the back doors are closed, you know, and this is it. I'm in it for the duration. 99% is not 100%. Vows as freedom or vows as limiting my freedom. I talked about that earlier, right? And then, should I keep it quiet if I become a Buddhist? By all means, keep it quiet. Don't tell anybody. Closet Buddhist. You know, I tell my kids, they go to an Episcopal school, I tell them, if somebody asks them about their religion or their spiritual path, I say, just, the Dalai Lama said it. He said, my religion is kindness. So, you know, I tell them your religion is kindness, change the subject. Don't get into a discussion about right and wrong, because that's not helpful. Should I keep it quiet if I'm a Buddhist? Completely. You know, I think for most people, it's better, again, it's an inner practice, isn't it? We don't have to walk around with shaved heads and wearing robes and beads, all, you know, our prayer beads around our neck and all that kind of stuff. Although I have got my little blessing string here and things like that. But, you know, it's really important not to make a big show of it, but to make it a personal and a private thing. How soon can I expect to see results? How soon? Anybody have an answer? Robbie, you've been doing this a while. Pardon? Yeah, this is America. We want it now. We are the now generation. Why not now? I can't tell this story, but I should. Well, anyway. I better not tell that. Well, I will. So I was at a teaching one time with the Dalai Lama in Los Angeles, and people were, this is the first time I've ever told this. I think Robbie may be the only one that knows this, because he was there. But I wrote down the question, and I was really thinking about Tantra when I asked the question. But I said, what's the quickest way to get enlightened? And I thought he might use that to segue into a discussion of Tantra, but what he did was he started crying. He said, "Oh my God, you know, this is, you know, it really, you know." He said, "This is what you know everybody wants, particularly in this culture. We want it now. We want it." It brought him to tears, and I felt terrible. And Robbie was pointing at me, you know.
10,000 people.
He asked the question. but then he answered it, you know, he said, "This takes time. This is not the Prozac or the ECT, you know, the electroconvulsive therapy method, the quick fix. It's not the Xanax, you know, method here. But it's moderate effort over time. That's really how we need to approach the practice. This is something I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it. I'm not going to bail on it. And I can promise you, if you practice, and I committed many years ago, like, I mean, I don't know, 78, long time ago, so 37 years ago. And has my practice been at a high level for that many years? Absolutely not. But, you know, there have been times when there have been surges of energy and times when there's been less. And you can talk to other Buddhists, they all have the same experience. I mean, but the ideal way is to keep a moderate, steady effort over time. You know, this up and down like I've been doing is not the best way to do it, but a steady effort over time. But the point is, no matter, even if I've had a bad week or two or, you know, a month, it's like those, you know, for people who've really taken refuge in their heart, there'd never be a question, you know, that Buddha, that the Dharma is the refuge. And then, you know, you get back on the cushion, you get back doing the practices, and you start taking the medicine again. So you know, if you take refuge, it will be the practice of a lifetime, and it will not always go well. There will be, in fact, they say that once you take refuge, I don't know if I should tell this or not either. All right, once you take refuge, though, problems will be coming like a windfall. You're just going to be inviting problems because this is how you grow. And it sounds crazy, but, you know, but once, you know, the teacher said, "Oh, yeah, you take refuge, you have lots to work with then." But I think it's already there. I think the problems are there. We just haven't been paying attention to them. But things will come up, and now you see them as a teaching from the guru, as an opportunity to practice the Dharma, an opportunity to grow. So vows of freedom, Hashim. And is that the end? One more. If someone criticizes me or my family, kids, for choosing the Buddhist path, what is the skillful way to handle it? Anybody want to answer that? This is relevant in our culture, isn't it? Because we have very strong, robust children's program here. And, as many as 50 kids come on a Sunday. And, well, I can tell you this. Miranda, who's Jill's daughter, said when she first, when she goes to public school, and when they found out her student, because she's not shy about saying that she's a Buddhist, and she got a little grief about it, but now people are interested in it, and they don't pay, nobody seems to pay attention to it anymore. I don't know exactly why, but there's a lot less, because maybe we the culture in this community has gotten so diverse, and there are lots of Hindu temples and so forth, but it's pretty unusual to see a Westerner who's embraced Buddhism. So, but anyway, the most skillful way to handle it, I think, is to listen to people and avoid getting into my, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. That's just crazy. You know, best thing to do is avoid it. Avoid getting in any kind of confrontation. But if somebody asks you about Buddhism, if you're a Buddhist, or even if you're not and you know something, it's okay to answer them. But I think going around standing on street corners, you know, trying to convert people, that's not the Buddhist method. That's not the Buddhist way. Should I raise my children as Buddhist? I'm trying to, but I can only get them here every other week. But for years and years, I would bring them here when they were little. I think most of you know, I mean, some of you know I have younger children. used to bring them here. Even when they were so little, they didn't know where they were. And I'd just take them around, you know, because maybe this is just, you know, I think there might be some kind of positive energy here. And I don't know exactly how it works, but I thought, well, couldn't hurt, might help. So, you know, I would bring them here, and they'd hear the teachings. They couldn't understand anything, of course. And now that they're older, they'd much rather stay home and watch and play with computers and watch video games. But, you know, I think the cause of happiness is good karma. Cause of happiness is good karma, because that creates merit. So we, in Buddhism, we say merit or virtuous karma is the cause of happiness. So, you know, and purifying our negative karma is also the cause of happiness. And I think, this is again Don Brown talking, but I think that even though, and I've got experience, my kids many times don't want to come, but usually when they've come, they've almost 99 out of 100 times have had a good time and are pleased to have been here. But I think they can create more positive karma here than they can at home. If I thought they could create more positive karma at home, I'd keep them at home. And for, you know, before we had a children's program, I did keep them at home. And we just do things. All right, what are some of the other challenges what are some of the other challenges of choosing in a Judeo-Christian North America? Choosing Buddhism, I guess. I guess I'll leave that one for another day. I know, but you know, this being a Buddhist, choosing Buddhism in this culture, I will say this from my side, all of my brothers and sisters are born again Christians. All right, so we get together. One brother asked me one time about Buddhism. It was only to try to tell me that I was going to hell, and he was praying for me. I'm serious. The rest of the time, and the other times, none of them ever asked me about it. And I'm fine with that. And I'm not going to tell, I will not say a word about it unless they ask it. My sister, she's actually taken some meditation classes and stuff, so she's more open to it. But my four brothers, no interest at all. And that's fine. But I think, you know, some of the friendships fall away. You know, my best friend growing up, you know what his favorite thing, two things to do are? Hunt and fish. If I want to hang out with him, have to go kill birds or deer or whatever, you know, and go catch fish. And I've made a promise not to take, you know, to harm any living being when you take, you know, vow to become a Buddhist. So, you know, giving up fishing. My girls went fishing this, one of them went fishing this summer, and she said, I was praying I wouldn't catch anything. You know, so it's, anyway. All right. Anybody have any thoughts about this last one before we wrap it up? I think that's the last of it, isn't it? Yeah. Any thoughts about the challenges of, I do think though that, you know, your friendships, some of your friendships may fall away, and that might not be a bad thing. Yeah, the question over here. Thank you for coming, those of you who showed up, and have a good evening. Dedicate the merits.
Is this working? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I
we still have one more class, by the way, next week. It'll be more meditation, 6:30 to 9:30 or 9 o'clock. We'll say 9:15, something like that. 10, yeah.
I tried to raise children Unitarian in Eastern North Carolina, and that's about on the same level as raising children as Buddhists. And it was a continual struggle, but it also was very strengthening, because you had to be strong in your belief system in order to explain to people who were appalled at your choices. And you have to be willing to accept discrimination for your work, for who will allow you to associate with them, your social position, and all kinds of other stuff. If you want to be publicly other than
a Judeo, well, in Eastern North Carolina, Jewish people have a hard time as well as Catholics.
Well, I'm from Greenville.
Well, Catholics have
that's
had
Eastern,
to do,
that's about as east as you can go.
Had to do mass in private. They didn't reveal that they were Catholics. So there is a great deal of challenge when you are not of the norm.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's changing though, thankfully. I don't think it'll be much of an issue in a generation. I mean, even in this generation, I've seen such a shift. You know, that's why, I mean, Kadabra Center, I mean, I can't tell you, you know, over the years, thousands of people have come through these doors. Not everybody's become a Buddhist, but they've been exposed to it. And so they don't, you know, it's not so weird, but, you know, things are changing.
But the mindset is different in Raleigh than it is.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. Well, it's maybe we need to have some satellite centers in Greenville and Eastern North Carolina. Okay. So thank you for the PowerPoint. Great job. All right. So let's do dedication prayers. And then we'll wrap it up. Now, those of you who have any interest in taking refuge, there's this little booklet, which will definitely bewilder you, probably. But it's okay. You know, read it. And again, read it in the spirit that it's, you know, meant to be, to help us develop ourselves. And any questions you have, you can save them for Geshe Gelek when he comes back. I'll try to answer them. But, you know, there are a lot of people here at the center that can answer these. Because a lot of people have taken refuge over the years. So let's do the dedication verses. And then what page we are? 246, yes. Okay. All right. So what is dedication? Let me say something about that. So I've tried to figure out what it means. I mean, dedicate the merit. And there's a lot of ways we can think about it. Like this positive seed that we've created here tonight, individually and collectively, like we want to dedicate these. We want to send them off in a direction that's going to be beneficial to all beings. So that's kind of how one way to think about dedication. But it's also like, it's also acknowledging that we've done something virtuous, that we've done something positive, and rejoicing in that. So whenever we do something virtuous or positive and we rejoice in it, we're more likely to do it again. So we want to, in a real sense, we're rejoicing in our own, the positive potentials that we've created here tonight. Alright, so we'll do this Shanti Deva's prayer. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrows find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. Medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. One last thing. I bought this book, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I will one day. It's a whole book on the power of giving your word. the power of giving your word and living your word as your bond. And I really think of refuge as like that. It's like in taking vows, it's like that. It's so powerful when we keep our word to other people for simple things, little things, big things, everything. So this is the here taking refuge is like we're entrusting, you know, as one teacher said, our spiritual real estate, you know, to this path. It's a big deal. It's a big deal, not to be taken lightly, but something to consider. All right, thank you.